Then the governor's soldiers took Jesus to the praetorium and gathered round him. They stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him, and then twisted together a crown of thorns and set it on his head. They put a staff in his right hand. Then they knelt in front of him and mocked him. "Hail, King of the Jews," they said. They spat on him, and they took the staff and struck him on the head again and again. After they'd mocked him, they took off the robe and put his own clothes on him. Then they led him away to crucify him. As they were going out, they met a man from Cyrene called Simon, and they forced him to carry the cross. They came to a place called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. There they offered Jesus wine to drink, mixed with gall, but after tasting it, he refused to drink it. When they'd crucified him, they divided up his clothes by casting lots, and sitting down, they kept watch over him there. Above his head, they placed the written charge against him: "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." Two rebels were crucified with him, one on his right and one on his left. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, "You who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. Come down from the cross, if you are the Son of God." In the same way, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders mocked him. "He saved others," they said, "but he can't save himself. He's the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross, and we will believe in him. He trusts in God. Let God rescue him now if he wants him. For he said, 'I am the Son of God.'" In the same way, the rebels who were crucified with him also heaped insults on him. From noon until 3 in the afternoon, darkness came over all the land. About 3 in the afternoon, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eli, Eli, lema sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" When some of those standing there heard this, they said, "He's calling Elijah." Immediately, one of them ran and got a sponge. He filled it with wine vinegar, put it on a staff, and offered it to Jesus to drink. The rest said, "Now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to save him." And when Jesus had cried out again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. At that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook, the rocks split, and the tombs broke open. The bodies of many holy people who had died was raised to life, and they came out of the tombs after Jesus' resurrection and went into the holy city and appeared to many people. When the centurion and those who were with him, who were guarding Jesus, saw the earthquake and all that had happened, they were terrified and exclaimed, "Surely he was the Son of God."
Bible, because we will be referring to a couple of other passages as well. So do open it in front of you. There are going to be no verses on the screen. That's the way I like it. I like Bibles in hands, so we can have a look. Some places fill us with awe, like the Grand Canyon and the Great Barrier Reef, the Niagara Falls or the Great Wall of China. And some people fill us with awe, like Martin Luther King and Winston Churchill, Albert Einstein and Nelson Mandela. Some places and some people fill us with awe. And this morning we're going to a place and to a person that can fill us with awe. The place is called Golgotha, and the person is the Son of God. This morning we're looking at Matthew 27 and the crucifixion, the death of Jesus Christ. And as we look at his crucifixion, there's a lot to see. There's shame and weakness and defeat. But there's more to this crucifixion than meets the eye. Yes, shame. Yes, weakness. Yes, defeat. But that's just what's on the surface here. Under the surface, there is a lot more to see. In fact, why don't you have a look at verse 54? Verse 54, this is after Jesus dies. When the centurion and those with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and all that happened, they were terrified. Or in another translation, the English Standard Version, it says, the centurion and those with him were filled with awe. This commanding officer and his soldiers, when they see the death of Jesus, they're terrified. They see shame. They see weakness. They see defeat, as they have done 100 times before. But there's more to this crucifixion than meets the eye. They see this crucifixion and they're terrified. They see this crucifixion and they're filled with awe. They exclaim, "Surely, surely he was the Son of God. This dead man is the living God himself." And so the question for us this morning is this: what did they see? What did they see that terrified them? What did they see that filled them with awe? Because if we can see what they saw, we too will be terrified. And we too will be filled with awe, and our lives will never be the same again. The question for us this morning is, what did they see? And Matthew 27 gives us at least three answers. Firstly, they saw shame and glory. They saw shame and glory, verses 27 to 31. In the first half of Matthew 27, which we looked at last week, Jesus had been humiliated. On the Thursday evening, he was arrested and accused. On the Thursday evening, he was attacked. The chief priests and the elders spat in his face and they struck him with their fists. On Friday morning, Jesus was bound and he was beaten again and again and again. In verse 27, Jesus is still standing, but only just. His body has been broken. And that was just the start of the humiliation for Jesus. Have a look at verse 27. The governor's soldiers now take him into the praetorium, the palace. And it's a private place. And they gather the whole company of soldiers round him. A large crowd, maybe between 100 and 200 people. A couple of the soldiers strip Jesus. He's naked. Another soldier puts a scarlet robe on him. Another has twisted together a crown of thorns and pushes it hard onto his head. This soldier is not gentle. He is rough. The thorns are more than 10 centimeters long, and this soldier pushes them onto his head. Another soldier puts a staff in his right hand. Jesus is still standing, but only just. And then one by one, these soldiers kneel in front of Jesus, mocking him. Hail, King of the Jews! Hail, King of the Jews! And as each soldier gets up, they spit in his face. They take the staff and they beat him on the head with it. And that happens again and again and again. And with each blow, there's a cruel cheer. These soldiers are loud. They're laughing. Jesus is beaten and battered beyond recognition. And Jesus isn't standing anymore. After each soldier has had their turn, perhaps some have had a second, they stop. They strip Jesus again. He's naked. This scarlet robe is pulled off. And they then put his clothes on and lead him away to crucify him. It's a short scene, verses 27 to 31, but the humiliation is easy to see. Jesus is stripped at the beginning and at the end, twice, naked and shamed. In the middle, Jesus is mocked, and that word mocked is used twice. The soldiers here want to humiliate Jesus, to demean him, to dishonor him, to disgrace him, and that's just what they do. But there's more to this scene than meets the eye. On one level, we see shame. But on another level, we see glory. There's mockery here, but there's majesty too. In this scene, Jesus is robed and crowned. He's given a staff. People kneel before him. He's hailed as the king. And these soldiers, they're obviously mocking Jesus. They don't actually think that Jesus is the King of the Jews. But there's irony here. This is ironic. What they can't see, we can see. So Matthew, the man who wrote this book of the Bible, he's been telling us from beginning to end, Jesus is the king. And Jesus is the king of everyone, everywhere. Flick back to Matthew chapter 1. It's on page 965. Matthew chapter 1, verse 1. This is the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David. And that title Messiah means anointed one or king. And Jesus is called the son of David, the greatest Old Testament king there was. Right from the start, Matthew chapter 1 verse 1, Matthew tells us Jesus is the king. And he's the king of everyone, everywhere. And then in chapter 2, we have the Magi from the east, aka the three wise men, and they're looking for a king. And then in chapter 3 you have John the Baptist, and he says, the king is coming. And then in chapter 4 you have Jesus himself saying, the king has come. And throughout Matthew, Jesus describes the kingdom of heaven. And throughout Matthew, Jesus demonstrates that he is the king. He heals the sick, he calms the storm, he raises the dead. Here is the king. And then you get Matthew 25, and Jesus couldn't be any clearer. We looked at this a few weeks ago. When the Son of Man, this is Jesus speaking, the Son of Man is Jesus. When the Son of Man comes in his glory, he will sit on his glorious throne. He's the king, and all the nations will be gathered before him. Jesus says, I'm the king, and I'm the king of everyone, everywhere. And now in Matthew 27, the king is robed, and the king is crowned, and the king is given a staff, and people kneel before him, and he's hailed as the king. The crucifixion is his coronation. Here is the king of heaven, the king of everyone, everywhere, for all to see. Now, that's not the glory yet. Turn back to Matthew chapter 20, page 988. In this chapter in Matthew 20, Jesus is talking to his disciples, and he's talking to them about authority. Have a look at verse 25. Jesus called them together and said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles, he's referring to the Romans, lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Jesus is saying, for most people, authority is about what they can get. It's about self-service. In verse 26, Jesus says, not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be your slave. Jesus is saying, authority isn't about what you can get. It's about what you can give. Authority is about service. And then we have verse 28. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve. And to give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus is saying, authority for me is about self-sacrifice. It's not about what I can get, it's about what I can give. And one day, I will give my life. I will give my life as a ransom for many. Now turn back to chapter 27. Matthew chapter 27, this is the day. The King of Heaven giving his life for people like us. For people like me and for people like you. Jesus giving his life to save us. And to save us from shame. To save us from shame. Most of us here have probably got a smartphone in our pockets. And smartphones have got cameras and microphones. Imagine if your smartphone recorded everything. Everything it saw you do. Everything it heard you say, at home, at school, at work, when you're with your parents, or with your spouse, or with your boyfriend or girlfriend, or with your children, when you're on your own, it records everything, day and night. And then at the end of each week, it's played. It's played on Facebook, or Instagram, or here at the Village Church. Imagine if that happened. How would you feel? I'd feel humiliated, rightly so. I've done things and said things, even this week, that are worthy of shame. And I've thought things. Imagine if my deepest, darkest thoughts were recorded and played for all to see. Imagine if your deepest, darkest thoughts were recorded and played for all to see. Wouldn't you feel humiliated, rightly so? Haven't you thought things that are worthy of shame? But here's what's happening in Matthew 27. Jesus Christ is serving people like us. He's sacrificing himself for people like us to save us from our shame. If you're a Christian here this morning, if you've turned and trusted in Jesus, whatever you've done this week or last year or in the past decades, whatever is worthy of shame in your life, Jesus has saved you from that. And when Jesus comes, and sits on that glorious throne. And when all nations are gathered before him, including each and every one of us, when everything is exposed, Christians will not be humiliated because he was humiliated in our place. Our shame, if you like, has been deleted. They saw shame and glory. The glory of the King of Heaven giving his life to save people like us. Secondly, they saw weakness and power. They saw weakness and power, verses 32 to 44. For a crucifixion, the vertical beam of the cross was usually left in the ground at the place of crucifixion. The horizontal beam, though, was carried by the victim. And when the victim arrived at the place of crucifixion, their hands were nailed to that horizontal beam. They were lifted up and suspended, and their feet were then nailed to the vertical beam. But here in Matthew 27, Jesus is too weak to carry his cross. Verse 32. The soldiers force a man called Simon from this place called Cyrene to carry the cross for him. Jesus is too weak. Then in verse 35, Jesus is crucified. The soldiers have stripped him again. He's naked, and they're dividing up his clothes. Verse 36, the soldiers sit down and keep watch over Jesus. Sometimes for a crucifixion, the soldiers would just leave the victim hanging there. But people had been known to try and help the victim down. And so the soldiers here keep watch over Jesus. No one is going to try and help Jesus down. He is helpless. He just hangs there. He is weaker than weak. But then there's mockery. Those who pass by hurl insults at him, verse 39. Shaking their heads and saying, "You who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. Come down from the cross if you are the Son of God." Now, Jesus had said that he would destroy the temple and raise it again in 3 days. And that's what the passers-by here are referring to. "You said you were going to destroy the temple. You'd need power to do that. But look at you now, Jesus. You're weak. You said you were going to raise the temple again in 3 days, but look at you now, Jesus. You'd need power to do that, and you're weak." But again, what they can't see, we can see. For the Jews, the temple was the place of sacrifice. And through sacrifice, they could meet with God. And Jesus has said, yes, the temple is the place of sacrifice. And yes, through sacrifice you can meet with God. But the temple is no longer a building. The temple is a body. When Jesus said that he would destroy the temple, he wasn't referring to their building. He was referring to his body. And through his sacrifice, people like us can meet with God. If you're not a Christian here this morning, do you hear what Jesus says? He says, if you want to meet with God, you can. You can meet with God as a child meets with their father. But Jesus says, you can only meet with God through me and through my sacrifice. There's no other way. If you don't turn and trust in me, Jesus says, you can't meet with God. So here in Matthew 27, we see weakness. The temple body of Jesus is being destroyed. And when we get to Matthew 28, we'll see power. The temple body of Jesus will be raised again. But I think here in Matthew 27, we also see power. Have a look at verses 41 and 42. In the same way, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders mocked him. "He saved others," they said, "but he can't save himself. He's the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross and we'll believe in him." They're saying that Jesus saved others. He healed the sick, he calmed the storm, he raised the dead, but he can't save himself. And when they say he can't save himself, what they mean is he's too weak. He's weak. His limbs are too weak. The nails are in his hands and feet. They're keeping him on the cross. But that's not why Jesus can't save himself. Jesus could call on his Father, and the Father would send 12 legions of angels to save Jesus. If Jesus wanted to come down from the cross, he could. But he doesn't want to. Jesus doesn't want to come down from the cross, and it's not because his limbs are too weak. It's because his love is too strong. You see, the Bible says that we're all rebels. We've turned against God, each and every one of us. We've ignored him and rejected him in one way or another. The Bible says there's a penalty to pay for that. Rebels like us deserve to be punished. But the God of the Bible loves rebels. And so he came up with a plan. God the Father sent God the Son to pay the penalty for us, to be punished in our place. And that's what's happening here in Matthew 27. The Son sacrificing himself to save sinners, to pay the penalty, to be punished in our place. And if Jesus saves himself, he can't save us. If Jesus is to save us, he can't save himself. That's what's happening here. And that's the power of his love. He won't save himself. He will save others. And if you're a Christian here this morning, you believe all that. But Christians can still question God's love for them. Does God really love me? Does God love loving me? Or is he deep down just a bit disappointed with me? Well, listen. God is pleased to love you. In fact, the Bible says it's God's pleasure to love you. He loves loving you. Do you remember Bert Laclos? Dave does. I knew Dave would remember Bert Laclos. So Bert Laclos is the father of Chad Laclos. And does that ring any bells? No, that's all right. I wasn't expecting that to ring any bells. Let me tell you. So Chad Laclos, he won a gold medal at the London Olympics in 2012. And his father, Bert, after Chad won the gold medal, was interviewed. And Bert just could not contain himself. He just kept saying, unbelievable, unbelievable, look at him, he's beautiful, what a beautiful boy, I love him, in his South African accent. Bert just could not contain how pleased he was with Chad. It was Bert's pleasure to love Chad. He loved loving Chad. Unbelievable, I love him, he's beautiful. It was almost a bit awkward. But in a similar kind of way, that's how God feels about his children. Christians have been justified, which means it's as if they've never disobeyed and it's as if they've always obeyed. We have the status of Jesus, and God the Father loves loving Jesus, and so God the Father loves loving Christians. Do you see? Unbelievable. I love him. I love her. What a beautiful boy, what a beautiful girl. God loves loving his children. That's the power of his love. So, they saw shame and glory. They saw weakness and power. And thirdly, they saw defeat and victory. They saw defeat and victory, verses 45 to 53. In verses 45 and 46, there is darkness and despair. Have a look. From noon until 3 in the afternoon, darkness came over all the land. About 3 in the afternoon, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, Eli, 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 lema sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? In the Bible, when darkness falls, it is not good. In the Old Testament, in the book of Exodus, Egypt experienced the judgment of God. And the judgment of God came through blood and frogs and flies and boil and hail and locusts. And the judgment of God came through darkness, a darkness that could be felt, a total darkness that covered the land for 3 days. And here in Matthew 27, darkness falls again. A darkness that can be felt. A darkness that covers the land for 3 hours. Jesus is experiencing the judgment of God. And he is in agony. Not just physical agony, but spiritual agony. This darkness leads him to despair. My God, why? Why have you forsaken me? Why have you abandoned me? Where are you? That's what causes him agony here. But again, the people standing there, they don't really see what's happening. They hear Jesus cry, Eli, Eli, and think he's calling Elijah. One of them gets a sponge, fills it with wine vinegar, puts it on a staff, and offers it to Jesus to drink. The others who are standing there say, now leave him alone, let's see if Elijah comes. None of the people here see what's really happening. And then in verse 50, Jesus dies. All the people there, what they see is defeat, darkness, despair, death. And that is there, obviously. But that's just what's on the surface. Under the surface, there's a lot more to see. So, one more reference. Turn back to Psalm 22, page 554. We read it earlier in the service. Page 554. So this is a psalm of David. It's written 1,000 years before Jesus. And in verse 1, David says, my God, why have you forsaken me? At the cross, Jesus repeats these words. And the reason he repeats them is because he wants us to have a look at Psalm 22. So look at Psalm 22, verse 6. David said, I'm scorned by everyone, despised by the people. So was Jesus. Verse 7, all who see me mock me. They hurl insults, shaking their heads. That's what they did to David. That's what they do to Jesus. Or verse 8, he trusts in the Lord, they say. Let the Lord rescue him. Let him deliver him. That's what people said to David. That's what people said to Jesus. Or verse 16, they pierce my hands and my feet. David wasn't crucified, but Jesus was. Or verse 18, they divide my clothes among them and cast lots for my garments. Do you remember the soldiers? They divided up his clothes by casting lots. Now, if these were the only verses in Psalm 22, it still sounds like defeat. But actually, Psalm 22 is a psalm of victory. In the present for David, there was despair. But in the future for David, there would be delight. And the same is true for Jesus. And we could look at a number of the verses in Psalm 22, but just have a look at the last couple, verses 29 to 31. All the rich of the earth will feast and worship. All who go down to the dust will kneel before him. Posterity will serve him. Future generations will be told about the Lord. They will proclaim his righteousness, declaring to a people yet unborn, he has done it. And so at the cross, when Jesus points us back to Psalm 22, he is saying, the same will happen for me. One day there will be feasting and worshipping. One day people will kneel before the king. One day people will proclaim his righteousness. There's despair in the present for me, says Jesus, but there will be delight in the future. At the cross, when Jesus cries the words of Psalm 22, it's not a cry of defeat. It's a cry of victory. I've come what I came to do. I've given my life as a ransom for many. I've done it. Do you see? A cry of victory. Okay, back to Matthew 27. We'll stay there. Matthew 27, in verse 50, Jesus dies. He gave up his spirit. And have a look at what his death does. Verse 51. At the moment when Jesus died, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. This curtain in the temple was a sign. And it was a sign of separation, no entry. God and people are separated. Behind the curtain is God, and you can't go in there. Only a high priest can enter, and only he can enter once a year, and only he can enter once a year once he's had carried out a whole series of sacrifices. But now, After the sacrifice of Jesus, that curtain is torn in two by God himself from top to bottom. It's like God removes the no entry sign and he replaces it with a flashing neon light. Welcome. Welcome whoever you are, wherever you're from, whatever you've done. Come in. Welcome. Meet with me. The death of Jesus is about reconciliation. And that is a victory. Reconciliation between God and people. And the death of Jesus is also about resurrection. Verse 51. At that moment, at the moment when Jesus died, the earth shook, the rocks split, and the tombs broke open. The bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life. They came out of the tombs after Jesus' resurrection and went into the holy city and appeared to many people. Can you imagine? Imagine the sound of rocks splitting and tombs breaking open. Imagine the sight of people who had died raised to life, men and women alive again. And they're not ghosts or skeletons. This isn't Halloween. These people are fit and healthy, alive and well, resurrected. And they go into Jerusalem and they tell people, he's done it. He's done it. He's defeated death. Death is dead. Through the death of Jesus, people have life. And that is victorious. That is a victory. And then we get verse 54. When the centurion and those with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and all that had happened, they were terrified. They were filled with awe. They exclaimed, surely, surely he was the Son of God. That's what the commanding officer and his soldiers saw that day. But I guess the real question is, what do we see? What do you see? When you look at the cross, what do you see? Shame? Yes. Weakness? Yes. Defeat? Yes. But there's more to this crucifixion than meets the eye. Do you see the glory? Do you see the power? Do you see the victory? When we go to this place, the place of the skull, when we see this person, the Son of God, for who he really is and for what he's really done,